Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show Monday through Thursday at 9 a.m. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, why the rush to the southern border? If you'd seen what journalist Sonia Nazario has, you'd know why. Sonia's story for the New York Times opens in the backseat of a small car in Honduras, where the owner of a bus is about to pay a bribe to a gang. Sonia is huddled out of sight, her phone recording video as the money is handed over in a kind of drive-through service. And this scene is repeated over and over again throughout the country. She writes, "The corruption is what allows all the other bad things to happen. It allows gangs to impose a reign of terror. It allows 9 in 10 murderers to get away with their crimes. It fuels poverty. As Sonia and I will discuss, it drives desperate people out anywhere for a better life." So as Sonia joins us, we welcome your questions about what's prompting people to seek asylum in the U.S. or to try to cross the border without documentation. And whenever we do a show about immigration, we get calls from some of you who say, why don't you talk about the conditions in the countries from which these people are coming to the southern border? So this is the show that you asked for with a journalist who has seen it firsthand. What do you want to know about the conditions in Central America? What are you curious about when it comes to immigration policy at the southern border and how it's affecting the countries from which these people are coming? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Sonia Nazario is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Her new article is titled Pay or Die. She joins us today from NPR West in Culver City, California. Sonia, welcome back. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Put us back in that car in Honduras. The bus driver is a businessman, and it appears to me that this is part of what is required, paying these bribes to do business. Is that right?
That's right. Thousands of bus, taxi, motorcycle taxi owners every Monday morning are going through this process where they're paying 1, 3, or 6 gangs off. There have been about 1,500 transportation owners or drivers that have been killed in the last decade for refusing to pay this extortion or war tax to the gangs. So they pay or they die. And that morning I decided to see what it was like to make this payment. So this bus owner, he owns 3 buses, but he pays for about 55 buses total. He gets in his black car and I get in the back wheel well, and we go and collect this brick of money from the bus dispatcher, and then we go up into this neighborhood called Las Pavas, which is an 18th Street stronghold, one of the 2 main gangs in Honduras. And as we're climbing up the hill into this stronghold, there are these lookouts with, AK-47s watching as we go up, monitoring us. And as we reach the top, we stop, and these two young gangsters come out of nowhere. The driver pulls down the window 2 inches, shoves this brick of cash through the window,
wow.
And then the two gangsters disappear. And this money will go through many hands to reach the leader of the gang. And I spoke to another bus owner who pays $120,000 a year for his 35 buses to 3 gangs. And he feels lucky because other owners have to pay off 6 gangs. And it's estimated that about $23 million is paid in war taxes by these transportation owners just in the capital of Honduras every year.
And tell me what that payoff and these Monday payoffs to these single gangs or multiple gangs is actually buying a business owner. What do you get for the money?
It's buying your life. So if you refuse to pay, anyone on a particular bus route refuses to pay, they will randomly pick out a driver and kill them. They will chain the driver to the wheel of the taxi or bus and torch the vehicle and burn them alive. So you're paying basically for your life. And you try to negotiate with the gang the amount that you have to pay. But this is something that all these transportation owners virtually have to do in Honduras. And also many small mom-and-pop business owners have to pay these war taxes. It depends on what neighborhood you're in. It's largely the 18th Street gang that is charging store owners. But in the neighborhood where I spent a lot of time in the capital, a neighborhood called Nueva Suyapa that I've been going back to for 20 years, if you're in the 18th Street areas of control in that neighborhood, if you're a little mom-and-pop store that sells groceries out of your home or has a little business, you have to pay the war tax. And one in four businesses in that neighborhood in the last decade had shut down because they were unable to pay what was required to stay alive.
A call here from Jim in Stillwater. Hi, Jim. What are you interested in knowing about here?
Hi, how are you guys doing today? Great conversation. And it's about time that we talked about the conditions of those countries. We positively have to acknowledge what we, the United States, have done since 1900, invading those countries dozens of times in support of the American Food Company and any number of other issues that created the circumstances and the conditions that are there, backing right-wing death squad dictators who govern these countries. We reap what we sow.
What do you think, Sonia?
Well, it's absolutely true. The U.S. has a horrible history in these countries, and you mentioned United Fruit, and if there were presidents that were installed that were not going to be good for, you know, U.S. business interests in places like Honduras, we made sure to change those presidents. And we fueled some of the corruption. In the 70s, there was the so-called scandal of Bananagate, where what was then United Fruit was paying off the president, you know, more than $1 million and promising even more than that to lower export taxes on bananas. And in the 1980s, we shoved a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars towards the government of Honduras basically buying their allegiance so that they would allow the Contras to operate in Honduras who were fighting against the Nicaraguan Sandinistas. And certainly, you know, in terms of the movement of drugs through Honduras that started in Colombia, and you had all these drug flights landing or drugs moving through Honduras on the way to the biggest consumer of illegal drugs in the world, the United States. And that has generated a lot of this violence as well. So there are many ways in which the U.S. has fueled this violence and this corruption. That said, there are many, you know, local actors who have done this as well. So I don't want to place the blame solely at the feet of the United States. But the U.S. has been a major player in this, and I believe should play a role in terms of foreign humanitarian aid, not military or police aid, but humanitarian aid in funding anti-corruption groups and groups that work to reduce the violence and change the conditions. That is what ultimately is going to slow the flow of people heading north.
Your article gives us a sense of how deep the corruption runs, and I want to talk about that in a minute. But you've also given us a scale of how many gangs are on the take and what this means for business owners in Honduras. What are the gangs doing with all of the money?
Well, some of it, a lot of it funds the toros, the big cheeses who are locked up in prison and supporting their extended families. And, you know, some people would say there are enough gang members that if you spread it around in terms of, you know, feeding people, you're paying, in the neighborhood I was in, Nueva Suyapa in the capital, you're paying a kid maybe $20 a week to sell drugs for the gang. You're giving them their food. You're buying them a gun. So if you spread it around amongst tens of thousands of gang members on the outside and supporting the people inside prisons and their families, that's what it largely goes for.
You need a constant flow of cash.
That's right.
To make that work. A call here from William in Hastings. Hi, William. What do you want to add to the discussion here?
I just kind of want to add that I think it's really a sad condition that a lot of these individuals go through. I've worked in the construction industry for years with a lot of undocumented immigrants and heard many, many stories of rapes and kidnappings and murders and dead people in the desert and just horrible, horrible stories during the journeys. And I think one of the ways to potentially solve the problem is back in their home countries, doing a little bit of marketing, if you will, trying to educate people that it's not always a wonderful life here in the States, because a lot of them live in abject poverty once they're here. And when they're in their home countries, they're told that it's going to be wonderful and everything's going to be great and they're going to be able to send tons of money back home. And a lot of that is done by the coyotes and the criminal gangs themselves. They market this because it's their business. So if we'd spend a little bit of money on marketing and educating people that it isn't always great, maybe that would help slow things down a little and save some lives.
Sonia, is that right, what William describes, that the coyotes tell people if you can just get into the United States, you know, all your problems are solved?
Yeah, I think that there is this marketing by the smugglers and the coyotes. I think also when people come to the United States, when they phone friends and family back home out of pride, they tend to talk up all the good stuff. You know, I'm making $8 an hour. I have a car. No one in my pueblito has a car. What they don't say is I'm working two or three jobs. I'm sleeping 5 hours a night. I might be stuffed into an apartment with three other families, living in a converted garage, struggling to pay my bills here. Send $100 a month home to my children that I've left behind in my home country. So they don't talk about the bad stuff. They only talk about the good stuff. And that creates this misimpression of life in the United States. And also, you know, people send money back to the remittances. The money that they send back to these countries is often the second largest source of income, GDP, in these countries.
Wow.
And people take that money and they, you know, they build much nicer houses than the huts that are in many of these neighborhoods. And so you can physically see what that money does in neighborhoods in Honduras. And so people see that nice concrete, you know, monoblock house compared to the wooden shack. And they say, well, life must be much better there. And in an economic sense, it is much better in the United States. But people have to live in complete fear of being picked up. You know, we saw these raids in Mississippi over the past week where families are being torn apart. So a lot of that doesn't get filtered back south.
I want to ask you a bit about the gangs. You've mentioned the 18th Street gangs operating in this neighborhood, and I think that was the gang involved in the payoff that you observed. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So President Trump has spent a lot of time raising fears about MS-13. He implies that MS-13 is operating without impunity, I guess, in the United States. I want to play a bit about how he talks about this gang's operations in the U.S.
Together, we're going to restore safety to our streets and peace to our communities. And we're going to destroy the vile criminal cartel MS-13 and many other gangs. But MS-13 is particularly violent.
What can you tell us, Sonia, about how they work in Honduras and Central America and then here?
Well, let's start with that. MS-13 and 18th Street both started in Los Angeles, where I live.
Huh.
These were gangs. You know, 18th Street was a largely Mexican gang during the Central American Wars in the 1980s. People fled north from those countries, and they were picked on by the Mexicans, so they started their own gang, the Central Americans, MS-13, to protect themselves from the Mexican gang.
Hmm.
In 1996, we toughened laws towards permanent residents who had committed certain offenses, DUI, other offenses, and we started deporting permanent residents who had committed these offenses. And we deported about 300,000 criminals to Central America. And that really fueled a lot of the gang violence in these countries, because people describe in these neighborhoods that, you know, there were gangs, but they were largely they didn't use guns. They were mostly fighting over turf, not nearly as violent as they became once these gang members were dislocated from the U.S. and dumped in these countries. And so this really fueled a lot of this violence. People, you know, MS-13 is a violent gang in Los Angeles, but they're not nearly as violent as they are in Central America. In the neighborhood where I spent time, you know, the gangs, they abduct women. There was a 14-year-old girl who was abducted by an 18th Street gang, and they filmed as they were cutting off her arm bit by bit, and then they released that video. This is, you know, they cut women and people to bits. They skin women alive. They shoot them in the vagina. I heard about things that sent me back to therapy, because I was having nightmares after returning from Central America. So the level of violence is 10, 20, 50 times higher than you would see typically in places like Los Angeles. But these gangs exert enormous control in these neighborhoods. In the neighborhood I was in, you know, at the bottom of the hill was 18th Street, and in the middle was largely MS-13, and at the top was the 18th Street gang. And they've infiltrated many institutions. They're very, MS-13 in particular operates differently than 18th Street. They're very strategic. So they have sent people to study to become lawyers and accountants so that they can be better at money laundering. They've sent people to train to become doctors, and they're in the hospital so they can treat gang members who are injured and make sure they get out the back door if the police are coming. They've infiltrated the police. They've done a massive purge of the police in Honduras. 5,000 were let go of 13,000 police officers, and they found that 100 of these police officers, including some of the top police officers, were MS-13 gangsters.
Wow.
Their goal in Honduras is to control the police and control the courts and control the Congress. And this is how these problems, this impunity, thrives, because they pay off the cops, they pay off the judges, they pay off the prosecutors, and that allows this violence to go on unabated.
I think what you've described explains why in the piece you write that people are so afraid of the gangs that they don't even call them by their names.
I was trying to get them,
Sonia,
to describe, well, which gang is operating on your block?
Ugh.
And they would talk about elementos antisociales, antisocial elements. And it felt like Voldemort, you know, he who shall not be named. They were so afraid to even say the name.
Sonia Nazario is with us. You may have seen her new article, lengthy, fascinating piece in The Times called Pay or Die, about what it's like in these Central American countries from which many, many people are headed north to seek asylum to try to get into the United States. Many of them are now waiting in Mexico. Some are giving up. We heard a story this morning on NPR who are giving up and going back to their countries. But many go back to the kind of conditions that Sonia is describing in this story. I noted here in the introduction, we hear from a number of you when we talk about immigration, as we often do, who say, tell us more about the conditions in these countries from which these people are coming. This is that show. And Sonia has seen it firsthand and reported on it. So your questions, your observations, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. What do you want to know about the conditions in Central America? What do you want to know about the border policy and how that is affecting, and U.S. policy and how that's affecting the conditions in these Central American countries? 800-242-2828, anywhere you are in the Midwest here, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR, to Joy in Minneapolis. Hi, Joy. Appreciate you waiting.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi. What did you want to add to this, Joy, or ask about it?
Well, I actually tuned in right when I heard the Colonia Nueva Suyapa mentioned, because I lived there for 6 months in 2009 in college doing an internship at an NGO.
Mm-hmm.
And That was.
I know which one. Yes.
Yes. Yes. I hardly ever hear that mentioned, so I was really excited. But I was there right as the military coup was happening with Manuel Zelaya, and then saw the fallout of that. And I have kept in touch with the family I lived with pretty well up until a couple of years ago. It can be hard to reach them. They don't have a great internet connection. But I just was so impacted by my time there. It's literally changed my politics. It has impacted the decisions I've made, where I've decided to work, the profession I've chosen, where I've decided to live in Minneapolis. And I'm so thankful for my time there.
What kind of work are you doing now, Joy?
I'm a legal aid attorney at Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid.
Excellent.
Doing family law.
Excellent. So you have not been able to find out how the family that you lived with is doing?
I haven't spoken with them recently, but when I did speak with them, the husband of the family is a fine artist. He paints. He's self-taught. He's very, very talented. But I know that pretty much in the last 5 years, he hasn't been able to sustain their family in Honduras alone, partially because of the economic fallout from the political situation. When I was there, I remember not being able to get a taxi driver sometimes that would take me back to the house because the taxi drivers were so afraid of Nueva Suyapa.
Oh, wow. I really appreciate the call and your own experience with this, Joy.
And Joy, I'm guessing you work with the nonprofit called the Association for a More Just Society?
Yes, that's the one.
Okay. So I think this is a critical element in that that's a nonprofit that's the arm of Transparency International in Honduras. And so they are battling, they are one of the three main players in Honduras that's battling corruption and trying to lower violence. And the U.S. ramped up foreign aid to Central America after the surge of migrants that we first saw coming to the U.S. border in 2014. But recently, President Trump has cut off foreign aid to these countries, saying that they're not doing enough to stop migration, that this is flushing money down the toilet. And so groups like ASJ are looking at having to slash their operations from 140 people to 40, as I describe in the story. And this is a group that has trying to highlight, bring to the surface the kind of corruption that exists with the school system, with the medical system. The schools had all these fake teachers that weren't actually in the schools. The hospitals were handing out fake medicines and people were dying as a result. Thousands of people are thought to have died in a four-year period. So all of this corruption kind of trickles down into these neighborhoods and the everyday lives of people. And what I advocate in this story is that we need to continue foreign aid, especially humanitarian aid that funds these vetted international aid groups and civil society groups like ASJ in Honduras, because I have seen that their work, and I've described this in previous New York Times pieces, I have seen how their work reduces violence and reduces impunity. One of the huge issues in Honduras is that you can kill someone with no consequences. 9 in 10 people get away with it. And groups like ASJ were really battling that. And what we're doing is the opposite of what we should be doing. That said, you know, we need to set clear benchmarks for to show that this foreign aid is working and it should go to these vetted groups. And we should recognize that this is going to be a 10 or 20 year battle. But ultimately, trying to change things in these countries is way cheaper and more humane. And as your previous caller said, more people prefer to stay in the countries where they're from, where they, with everything that they know and love, than have to leave that. It's cheaper and more humane and more effective than trying to make things so nasty here in the United States, put everyone in these horrible prisons. It works better and it's more humane, and it's going to cost us much less to do that than fund billions of dollars into this prison system.
You use the word despair in this piece, and you write about how Hondurans are seeing their institutions, you know, just rot from the inside because of this corruption. And you write, Honduras makes the swamp in Washington look like a piddling puddle. It's what throughout the military and education and the medical system? Is there really no institution that Hondurans can trust?
Not really. And that's why they're in the streets protesting every day now. And the rot really starts at the top with the president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez. His brother was jailed in the United States late last year and accused of being a major drug trafficker, bringing in tons of cocaine to the U.S. and labeling the cocaine shipments, the bricks of cocaine, brazenly with his initials. The president there's two ways basically to get rich illegally in Honduras. You can either take money from drug traffickers to allow these drugs, help them move these drugs through Honduras onto the United States, or you can steal from the public coffers. And his brother is accused of doing, the president's brother is accused of doing the first, and his sister and the president's family is accused of doing the second. The
wow.
sister, as I highlight in, she died in a helicopter accident in 2017, but she is accused of allegedly setting up these nonprofits that were supposed to funnel funds from the government into services for the poor, but instead using that money for personal purposes or to fund her brother's presidential campaign in 2013. He won the presidency for the first time in 2014. And this group ASJ, which your caller interned for, is about to come out with a study showing that about $87 million of public funds went to two nonprofits that are linked to the president's family. And these were no-bid contracts, no accountability of where the money went. So there's this sense that in terms of people in Congress, people in the executive branch, that there is skimming of money, that 30-40% of the entire budget, government budget of Honduras, is going to corruption.
I want to get a call in here before we take a news break to Mono in Champlin. Hi, thanks so much for waiting. What question do you have for Sonia?
Well, you partially answered my question, but one that still remains is, are they the same gangs that are pushing people out, in other words, terrorizing the people while they're living there, who are also then offering their coyote services, or are they working together?
Good question.
I found that largely the gangs are not operating as smugglers and coyotes. Their business is more local. In most of these neighborhoods, everyone knows the smuggler who lives in the neighborhood and has a track record of getting people to the United States. And they basically say, we'll try three times to get you there for this price. And people mortgage their hut at very high interest rates. I will pay you this much a month in interest, 20, 30, 40, 50% in interest. And if I can't pay off the loan by getting to the United States and sending money back, then basically you can take my hut, my little piece of land. So these gangs are mostly focused on selling drugs and these extortion rackets that I describe. That's the way they make their money.
Sonia Nazario is with us. We're talking about a piece that she reported on and published in the New York Times. It's called Pay or Die. She spent months and has a lot of experience in Central American countries. She was in Honduras. She observed how payoffs are done. She writes in this piece about how high up the corruption goes, including, and I want to talk about this on the other side of news, including in the medical system, where she describes this ring of criminals who stole millions from the country's healthcare system. So we'll talk about that. I am also getting some questions here on Twitter about prescriptions for this, solutions for it. One listener is asking about a kind of Marshall Plan for Central America. So we'll cover that as well. And more of your calls and questions, 800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 and on Twitter. Sonia, I'm going to go right to the phones here. A number of people want to have some questions for you too. Another Sonia in Minneapolis. Hi, Sonia. Thanks for waiting.
Hi there. I have a long history with Central America. In the 80s and 90s, I was leading educational group tours to the region to help U.S. citizens understand some of the complexities of the region so they could contribute to debates about U.S. policy at the time. I have a Central American family. I have a family member who was detained for a year at the age of 17 because of her involvement in MS-13. Mm-hmm. And in some of these low-income neighborhoods, it's very hard not to become involved in the gangs. The recruitment is super intense, and that's one of the reasons people are leaving.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I wanted to mention, in addition to echoing an earlier caller who talked about long-term U.S. patterns of not respecting these countries' borders and sovereignty,
mm-hmm.
And creating the conditions that are causing them to flee now. One of the things that's going on right now is the new Salvadoran president, Nayib Bukele, who's taking a very strong stand against gangs in El Salvador. One of the effects that is having, some of the gang members from El Salvador are now moving into Guatemala.
Yeah.
And that makes Guatemala even a dicier place to live and makes the whole idea of having Guatemala be a safe third country even more hard to fathom.
It's a good thing to ask Sonia about. Sonia, what do we know about whether any of the governments are confronting this kind of corruption and then what the consequence of that is?
Well, Guatemala has basically kicked out the anti-corruption international group that was sponsored by the UN because it targeted the president's son and then was investigating the president. So the response was basically the previous president. We have a new president as of today. And so he basically kicked that organization out. And there's concerns that as the Organization of American States anti-corruption group in Honduras has been zeroing in on congressional people and politicians high up, that they have jailed the son of the former president and the wife of the former president, are investigating the former president, et cetera. So that group's mandate ends in January, and that they will be kicked out as well. So there has been, you know, there is a new president in El Salvador, and he says that he's going to be different and he's going to go after corruption, that he's not going to be corrupt. We saw this in Guatemala with the last president, and he's alleged to be more corrupt than anyone else. So we'll see. In the past, the policies in these countries has been a mano dura, a hard hand with these gang members to basically lock them up in these horrible prisons where they come out even worse. And I think it remains to be seen what the new president in El Salvador will do. A lot of people believe that what you need in these countries is what we've done in the United States to lower gang violence, which is to work with gang members to offer them alternatives to gang life when they're coming out of prison, to offer them employment, to offer them counseling, to offer them, it's called tertiary intervention, to really work with these gang, especially the people who are doing the shooting, to work with these folks to try to change their lives. And we've seen very little of that in Central America. The first contract went out in Honduras to try to do this kind of work in the last 6 months or so, but there's very little of it. And a lot of people in the United States believe that to reduce gang violence, you need to work directly with these gang members. And you have to offer young people in these neighborhoods an alternative. In the neighborhood I was in, Nueva Suyapa, half of the people 18 to 25 have no jobs. Mm. And, you know, you're facing not being able to eat or feed your children. And so when the gang offers you $20 a week to sell drugs on the street corner, you know that that life may lead to your death or may lead to your being in prison. But when it's the only option to be able to eat, far too many people turn to that option.
You know, I had a question about the criminal justice system, and I noted this before we went to news, that you described this ring of criminals who stole millions of dollars from the country's healthcare system. But you also say that they were caught and convicted and sent to prison, which made me wonder, is the criminal justice system, at least in Honduras, working in some way that people are still being arrested and convicted?
The sense in Honduras is that over the last 4 or 5 years, these three anti-corruption groups have brought many cases to light, such as the one with the national insurance system, which was found to have skimmed $300 million from the health system that people use who are in the formal economy, that this system was handing out drugs that were no better than placebos, basically. They were handing out drugs for diabetes and hypertension that simply were chalk dust. They didn't work at all, and that thousands of people died as a result of these. And these the leaders of this health system were basically taking money from drug companies as kickbacks to provide these bad drugs or horrible ambulances that were really vans that had been converted into ambulances. So there's been more cases that have been coming to light as a result of these organizations, many of whom are supported and funded by the United States, and now are seeing possibly that funding being cut. These organizations help bring these cases to light, but far too often, people don't, in high places, do not end up going to jail. And that's a lot of the frustration that you see among Hondurans, that if you steal a chicken, you're going to end up in jail for 20 years. But if you skim off hundreds of millions of dollars, somehow the system gets subverted where people don't end up in jail. And that's created these, helped fuel these protests on the streets.
Adriana tweeted in, grateful for this conversation, for shedding light on Honduras, proud to share the work that UNICEF does to facilitate psychosocial and violence prevention programs. We don't need to be yelled at. We want to be listened to, but one conversation makes a difference. And then Fonseca tweets, can Sonia talk about the war on drugs and the different initiatives that the U.S. have pushed for in South America and in Mexico?
The war on drugs has been a disaster. You know, our war on drugs started in Colombia with Pablo Escobar and others, and we squeezed Colombia, and the war moved to Mexico, and we squeezed Mexico, and the war moved to Central America, and now we're squeezing Central America. One reason that the U.S. supports this president is because he has allowed the U.S. to extradite many heads of cartels in Honduras. We have extradited, you know, more than 24 people to the United States for prosecution and for trials and for convictions. And so we have supported this president in theory because he's helping the U.S. in this war on drugs. And yet his own brother was moving drugs to the United States. And a week ago, federal prosecutors in that case alleged that the president himself took $1.5 million for his presidential campaign to become president from the narco cartel. So it remains to be seen how those that all coming to light will affect our seeing this guy as our ally in the war on drugs. But now we're squeezing Central America, and the narcos are now moving more drugs through the Caribbean again, and we're seeing violence go up there. So we squeeze one place, and the flow of drugs moves, and the violence moves along with it, because these cartels are trying to control this turf to move these drugs north to us, the consumers. Ultimately, this violence will continue. It will just move around until we deal with the demand for drugs in the United States. And, you know, our war on drugs has been to lock up nonviolent drug offenders, and that's been shifting over the last decade. But I believe that instead of locking people up, we need to put a lot more into prevention and drug treatment, and God forbid, even try what Portugal has done. They legalized small quantities of all drugs, and it was a mess for a few years. Crime went up, as petty crimes went up, and thefts as you release these nonviolent drug offenders. But as you kick more money into these alternative approaches, today, drug use has been cut in half in Portugal.
Wow.
We have spent more than $10,000 per household on this war on drugs, and we're using as many drugs as ever in the United States.
Call for you here from David in St. Paul. Hey, David, thanks for waiting. Appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Hey, I was just, this is maybe off topic a little bit, but to me, when I think about these refugees, or I think about climate refugees and the impact of climate change is having on the countries. They don't have the resources that the United States have, so they can't move to another state, you know, so geographically challenged. So I was wondering if you could address how climate change is impacting these groups as well. Thank you.
And Sonia, I have been getting a number of questions about the coffee trade. So that might dovetail with what David's asking.
So I think absolutely climate change in Guatemala, even in Honduras, there's the so-called Corredor Seco, the dry corridor. And what you're hearing from farmers in that place is that the drought has produced these shriveled, ears of corn that they simply can't feed their families anymore on what the land produces. There's been a massive problem with coffee rust, so disease of the coffee plants. And there's been a plummeting in coffee prices internationally. And so all of that is driving people to the cities where the violence is often much greater. Often people will move first to the cities and then they encounter some sort of problem with the gangs. They try to recruit their son when they're 11 years old forcefully into the gang. Or as I saw with a girl at the top of the hill in the neighborhood I was in, 14-year-old girl refused the advances of a gang leader and she was going to buy eggs two blocks away at a little mom and pop store, and several gang members grabbed her and they dragged her for 20 blocks through the streets of this neighborhood and by her hair. And she was begging neighbors for a Bible because she knew what was going to happen to her. And people were so afraid they didn't come out to help her.
Oh my gosh.
And they took her to a casa loca. These are these houses that gang members take over from people. They kick people out and they cut her to bits. They raped her. They cut her to bits. Her father put her body back together. He buried her in her quinceañera dress with the crown that he had bought for her coming out party. This is what people are facing in these neighborhoods. So climate change is a huge element. And you know what? Our foreign aid, USAID, was using those funds to try to build irrigation projects in these dry corridors and teach farmers better methods for getting more food from their acreage given the conditions. And all of that is being cut with a cut by President Trump in foreign aid.
Yeah. By the way, for context here for listeners, $98 million in foreign aid in Honduras in 2016. And as Sonia notes, President Trump has ended that kind of money. To Paul. Hi, Paul. Your question for Sonia.
Yes. The church is really a strong entity in those countries. Is the church... could that be part of the solution, the church hierarchy, or are they just as scared as everybody else?
You know, I think traditionally in many of these places, and I saw this in my reporting in Mexico as well, often the church believes that they should stay out of these matters. And I found priests in Mexico, for example, who tried to get involved helping refugees would be told by other priests, you know, you should stick to baptisms and weddings and stay out of this. But increasingly, you're seeing some leaders getting involved with battling corruption. One of the three members of the Purge Commission for the police is a leader in the evangelical church. So I think the church has traditionally been very conservative, has sided with the elites and the rich, the military in these societies, and they need to be pushed much more to tackle these players and tackle corruption. As long as corruption continues, as long as, the judges can be paid off, the prosecutors can be paid off, the police can be paid off to look the other way, the corruption will go on unabated and the violence will continue.
Sonia, can you just say a bit here at the end of the kind of precautions that you take when you're doing this kind of reporting? How do you ensure your own safety? I mean, you're observing things that I assume the gangs and the corrupt officials don't want you to see and definitely don't want you to write about on the front page of the Times.
Yeah. You know, I had a piece a few months ago looking at why so many women are fleeing Honduras and the incredible violence, the level of violence that we're seeing as more women are recruited to sell drugs for the gangs. And also, you know, many are harmed just because of the machismo that we see in places like Honduras. I interviewed a woman who had her legs cut off by her husband with a machete because she had disobeyed him by going out one day. I try to go into neighborhoods where I've been before, where I know nonprofits like the Association for More Just Society, where I have a network of people. I often go out with social workers who kind of tell me, you can step here, but you can't step there. Mm. And sometimes I do face violence. I had someone shot in the head a block away from me one night, and I have close calls. But I think it's important to tell this story. The president is telling us that if you make things nasty enough for folks at our southern border, migrants will stop coming. But my experience is that if your house is on fire in a place like Honduras, you're going to find a way to get out of that house. And you may slow the flow temporarily as you do certain things, but the flow will continue until you address that fire in these places. And I think we have to address these root causes, and we have to show more compassion towards asylum seekers who are arriving at our southern border. These are people, you know, after World War II, during World War II, we turned away a ship with 900 Jews aboard, and hundreds of those Jews were murdered when they were sent back to Germany in the Holocaust. And we became, the U.S. became a leader in the modern-day refugee movement in saying, never again, we will not send people back to their deaths. And we have laws that say that we will protect people who come to our border and say, I fear being returned to my country. I am begging you for safety. And instead, we are metering people at the southern border. We're only letting 10 or 20 in at each port of entry. We're telling people, go and present yourself legally and ask for asylum. And yet we're only letting 10 or 20 people in a day into these ports of entry. And we have these camps of people south of the border waiting to be able to ask for safety. And even once they're able to get in, we're sending them back to these incredibly lawless towns on the southern border on the Mexican side. Like Tijuana is the most dangerous city in the world. And we're telling people, well, just park yourself there and wait for months while you're court hearing. And then you can come into the U.S. for your court hearing. We are treating people horribly. And we're setting them up for being kidnapped by the cartels on the southern border. We must treat these people who do arrive at our border more humanely. It's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do. And it is what our laws require of us.
I want to recommend for listeners an NPR story this morning from John Burnett, who reports on exactly what you're talking about. He's in Matamoros. All these people are living basically in a plaza waiting for, you know, their video-linked decision from a judge, right? Their hearing and then decision from a judge about whether they're going to get asylum. Most do not. What do they do after that? I've got about a minute left, Sonia.
I believe that we, most Americans believe that we should provide refuge to people. And when I focus on children who come to this country alone, and we're talking the number of children, even at the high now, is less than what you would fill a football stadium with of children per year. I believe we have that amount of compassion in us, and we can work to address these problems south of us.
Sonia, thank you so much. It's good to talk to you again. Be safe on the reporting, okay?
Thank you, Carrie.
Sonia Nazario's piece is called Pay or Die in the New York Times, and I will tweet out a link.
Just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. You can learn more about our show by searching for NPR News with Carrie Miller.